There'll be no legal slush fund for the State House Republicans who are looking to play games with gerrymandering. It's This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn with my colleague Laura Johnston, who's celebrating Canada Day, Jane Cahoon and Leila Tassi. It's Thursday, and we got lots to talk about. You guys raring to go, or is you limping into the weekend?
I thought it was already Friday.
Is it not a holiday in the United States then? I can't just take today off and call it
You can't even go to your home country. They're so slow in vaccinating. Okay, let's get going. What happened to the Republicans in the State House plan to have a legal slush fund to fight battles when they're challenged for what they do with redistricting and very likely gerrymandering? Because why else would you need the slush fund? Jane Cahoon, Mike DeWine vetoed some stuff in the budget overnight. What do we know?
Well, he issued 14 line item vetoes, and some of them are kind of technical, but there are a couple that stands out. As you said, he vetoed this provision that would have allowed the General Assembly to basically intervene in lawsuits that he thinks, you know, are the purview of the executive branch. And he said that this is virtually unheard of for state or federal courts to permit members of the General Assembly to intervene in lawsuits. And he said, the Attorney General, Dave Yost, requested that he veto this, and so he did. He said it really impinges on the separation of powers.
Let's put that into perspective, though, before you talk about the other ones. The Constitution puts the Attorney General as the state's lawyer. When the state is facing litigation, it is the Attorney General's job to deal with it. Sometimes, because of conflicts, they might hire a private attorney, but that's his job. I mean, that's not something that is for debate. So for the Senate and House Republicans to put that into the budget, it was a major power grab. It also did raise the question, why do you think you need to do that? If you follow the law and do what you're supposed to do in drawing these maps, why are you so worried about getting involved in the lawsuits? Dave Yost is more than capable enough to defend legal proceedings, right?
Right. And in fact, that's his job. He's the lawyer who is charged with defending state law. So that's what his job is. And I think DeWine said, you know, no.
Good for Mike DeWine. Score one for Mike DeWine. What else did he veto?
Well, he vetoed this language that would have vacated orders against liquor businesses that got in trouble for violating coronavirus orders, and would have, I think, refunded fines. And he said, you know, this really sends a message that the responsible businesses are not valued as much as the few businesses who failed, you know, sometimes repeatedly to take steps to protect their employees and customers from this deadly disease. So he struck that one down.
And that was part of the element in the House, kind of the fringe right that just opposed any kind of coronavirus restrictions and tried to hamstring the governor every time he tried to do something. I mean, the governor had put in rules for how bars could operate with distancing and other things, and they sent patrols around, and if people were violating it and risking the spread of coronavirus, they were fined, but the fringe wanted to take that all away.
And I was going to say, a lot of these cases, they were like repeated violations. When they saw something really reckless, when they saw just maybe somebody without a mask or something, a lot of times they would just educate them and so forth. But, you know, the ones that they really cracked down on were the ones that were really reckless. And so, DeWine said that just sends a bad message to let those people off the hook.
Okay, what else?
Well, you know, there's stuff on Medicaid. We're still sorting a lot of this out, and DeWine's going to talk about it this morning at a briefing. Looks like he missed the opportunity to veto that provision about the one where, you know, medical providers could refuse care to people because it violates their religious beliefs. So it looks like he landed on the side of religious freedom as opposed to the Hippocratic Oath, or however you want to frame that one. And he also, voting rights groups had wanted him to veto another provision that bars election officials from accepting private grants to pay for elections infrastructure. And it's a little more complicated than that, but the voting rights groups say this is really going to infringe on their efforts to, you know, sign up people to vote. And so that was not okay. well received by them either. But there's there's a lot more. But
I expect we'll be talking about this again on Friday once he explains what his thoughts were with his vetoes.
Right. It's fewer than the, by the way, I'm sorry, he issued 25 vetoes on his first budget in 2019. And so this one is fewer, but if anybody cares about that.
Okay. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Does the Donald Trump-backed opponent to Republican Ohio Congressman Anthony Gonzalez, who voted to impeach Trump, have a residency problem? Jane Cahoon, Sabrina Eaton put together a kind of a gotcha story. What's it say?
Well, you know, I wouldn't characterize it as really a residency problem. I think it's maybe more like a bit of a hypocrisy problem.
worse? I think I'd rather have the residency problem.
Yeah. So we're talking about Max Miller, the native Northeast Ohioan who's challenging Gonzalez in the Republican primary, largely over Gonzalez's vote to impeach Donald Trump for inciting the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. And one of Miller's talking points on the campaign trail is that Gonzalez isn't really a Northeast Ohio guy, isn't loyal to this area. So anyway, Sabrina Eaton reported that Miller, who had been living in Washington, D.C. while working as an aide for Trump, but he did buy a house in Rocky River about the time he announced his candidacy. He claimed a homestead deduction for his 2021 property taxes in D.C., which requires you to declare that that's your principal residence. So that's what he did. And he got a $648.98 homestead deduction when he paid his tax bill of $2,450.07 for this two-bedroom apartment he owns in Northwest D.C. And that was recorded a few days after he announced he was challenging Gonzalez. Now, he also, as I said, bought this $460,000 house in Rocky River. You know, he didn't claim a homestead exemption on that, but in Ohio, it works different. You have to be elderly, disabled, or low income. So it just works differently here. And Gonzalez, by the way, also owns property in D.C. and Rocky River, but he didn't claim that deduction. So, but Miller's campaign basically said this was a clerical error. His campaign issued a statement saying Max Miller lives in Rocky River and any suggestion otherwise is dishonest. And they said, due to an error made by Max's accountant, an automated property tax bill generated by DC's tax office with a homestead exemption was paid on his behalf. And after being made aware of this mistake, he's begun to the clerical process of settling it. So,
you know, we'd have to check, but most offices that handle this kind of thing don't automatically check the box of homestead exemption. It's something you've got to claim. You've got to proactively get it. It's not automatic and you say, I don't want it. You have to ask for it. So to say it's a clerical error of an automated bill, throwing the flag, I'm not buying that. Somebody had to claim it. And the fact that it's recorded 3 days after he announces he's running for Congress makes him look bad.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd just like to further explain kind of why we did this story, because, you know, really, you don't have to live in your district. I mean, that technically that's really not an issue. But why do we care? Mainly because Miller has really been out there raising questions about Gonzalez's ties to Northeast Ohio and to Ohio, even though, you know, Gonzalez grew up in Avon Lake. He went to St. Ignatius and Ohio State, where he was a football star. Miller has accused Gonzalez of basically abandoning the community, spending most of his time in D.C. and calling that troublesome. And in one interview, he claimed that Gonzalez is actually from California. Now, I know Gonzalez got his master's at Stanford and I think spent some time there. But and at Trump's rally over the weekend, Trump urged the crowd to vote for Miller because he grew up in this area and he's not a carpetbagger, you know. So anyway, it's just important to note
It's important to know when you're running for the U.S. Senate, you should keep your affairs in order. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's going on with homicides in Cuyahoga County? How much have they climbed in the suburbs this year? Laura Johnston, we've talked a lot about the high homicide rate in Cleveland, but now we know it's bleeding into the suburbs in a big way.
Yeah, this is a really alarming trend. As of Friday, when the most recent one was discovered, there's 36 homicides in suburban Cuyahoga County during the first 6 months of 2021. So 6 months even. And that's triple during the first half of 2020. In 2020, they had 12 homicides at the same time, 11 in 2019. For the whole year in 2019, there were 32 homicides in all of the county, 48 in 2020. So just consider that we're on pace to do 72. That's just a huge number. And we're dealing with soaring homicides and shootings everywhere. A lot of this has to do with the fact that there's just a lot of guns. People seem willing to use them if they get in an argument. But you look at the pandemic, mental health has been a huge concern. People had high unemployment rates. They were cut off from family and friends. And then there's a lot of civil unrest over police shootings, and there's substance abuse problems. We still have an opioid epidemic. And all of these things seem to be combining to just be this incredibly violent year.
Yeah, I raised the question this morning with all the law enforcement people that Adam Faris talked to saying, yeah, I don't know. I can't put my thumb on it. And I'm not quite sure why. You do wonder whether we are having that second epidemic that was predicted by mental health professionals last year, that the result of all of the upheaval of the pandemic would cause mental health stress like we've never seen. And this is the one of the manifestations of it. We know the opioid crisis has gotten way worse again, but is the violence all a product of that? We're going to try and do some reporting on that. Well, it's alarming how many suburbs have had homicides.
Like Broadview Heights had its first homicide since 1979. Valley View had its second since 1990. They've had five in Parma, including that five-year-old Jax, who authorities say was beaten to death by his dad. And you wonder, like, obviously we want to look at this mental health. We want to look at diagnosable issues, but also, like, you know, I feel like people's frustration tolerance was just kind of at the boiling point all the time. And so anything could set them over the edge. And we also did another story yesterday. Bianca Ramsey wrote about a blood shortage and one of the Red Cross hospitals' blood supply. And one of the reasons they said it was trauma centers and hospitals were using a lot more blood than they had expected. And you wonder if these are connected.
What's interesting is the American Red Cross claims there's a blood shortage pretty much every week of the year. And so when we get those things, you just think, okay, it's, you know, crying wolf. But this time, apparently, there really is a big blood shortage, and it's critical. And people who need blood are not getting it because there's so little of it. So they're hoping that a lot more people will give it. So interesting. Hopefully that trend will go down, but most officials are predicting it's only going to get worse. We are entering the July 4th weekend where if it's hot and a lot of people
are outside. And it's not supposed to be that hot. It's only supposed to be like in the low 70s until at least Monday. So I'm hoping that'll keep the tempers down.
Okay. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Why did Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson give a high-paying job to Phyllis Cleveland, who resigned from city council earlier this year? Leila Tassi, Mike White, Jane Campbell, in their final months, assaulted some loyalists away into decent jobs in various departments. It seems like the public utilities department is where they always stick people they're trying to protect. But this is, I don't want to say it's an outrage, but it kind of smells. What's going on?
It does. You know, we're still sorting through some of the questions surrounding this hire, but at first blush, it certainly smacks of patronage for a longtime Jackson friend and political ally. Phyllis Cleveland resigned on May 3rd from her council seat, which she held for 16 years. She cited health concerns and kind of a general reevaluation of her priorities in life. But during that time, she was also pretty embroiled in some heated issues in her ward. She was under a lot of pressure regarding the CMHA police shooting death of 19-year-old Arthur Keith back in November. Her constituents wanted answers from that investigation, and they felt like she just wasn't pushing hard enough. And then erupted that controversy surrounding that asphalt plant proposal that threatened to ruin the Opportunity Corridor project. Jackson was supporting that proposal, and it's not hard to imagine that Phyllis Cleveland was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place there. So when she resigned, it seemed like she would be kind of fading back into the private sector, having kind of cited these health concerns. But not a month and a half later, she pops up on the city payroll. Her new title is Administrative Manager of Governmental Affairs for the Department of Public Utilities. She'll be making $115,000, which is considerably more than she made as a council person. I think the salary there is like 80 or 85. And her duties will include supervision of the governmental affairs staff and handling of public records requests, which kind of always makes me laugh because we never get our records from any city department.
That must be a tough job to manage not giving them out.
I know. She will handle subpoenas and other inquiries made to the department. She'll be the liaison for local government officials and the Suburban Water Council of Governments, and she'll work on the department's water equity project and assist with legislation and other public utility issues. It's unclear whether the job carries civil service protection. That's one of the details Bob Higgs is chasing down today. But we also want to know, you know, who else applied for this? How did the city advertise the job posting? Was this
cherry pick for her? Right. I mean, does she have any qualifications to be a utilities person?
She's a lawyer, and so that might put her in a position to deal with those subpoenas and any of those legal issues. And I guess one could argue that her 16 years on city council gives her those skills as a liaison. I don't know how well she did as a liaison between the public and government. But, you know, one kind of interesting fact is that the person who held this title before Phyllis Cleveland is someone named Nate Wilkes, who coincidentally also spent a stint on city council in 2009 and 2010. It was brief, but still, you know, just city hall just seems so incestuous. At the very least, a new mayor will hopefully break that up. You know, bring in a fresh batch of cronies. That's what we need.
Well, when Jane Campbell was leaving, she put Mike O'Malley, current prosecutor in the utilities department. And it just seems like every time a mayor is leaving, they feel like they're empowered to just protect the bunch of people that they felt were loyal to them. But it really does bring about cynicism from the greater population because they don't get the chance to get $115,000 a year job. And like you said, did they advertise this? Did they have a lot of applicants? Are there people with other backgrounds that should have had it? Or is it just kind of a pass to a friend? We'll be watching this for the next 6 months as Jackson nears the end. The idea of patronage is one of the reasons city council is tripping over Jackson's plan to build a new department to handle events, because that would have a civil service protected job at the top of it. Not the highest paying job, I don't think, but still, it's a place you could salt away somebody else where no one could do anything to take the job away. Something to pay attention to. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Does Ohio Governor Mike DeWine have a conflict of interest in signing a law about Supreme Court justices and how they appear on the ballot, with his son being one of those justices and one who might be running for chief justice next year? Jane Cahoon, this one, I'm a little bit ambivalent on how I feel about this one, but it does seem like there's a pretty serious conflict of interest.
Yeah, I don't know that I would label it, you know, as that, but he certainly does have a special political interest in this legislation, let's just say. So we wanted to point that out in this story. DeWine says he plans to sign this bill into law, and it would require that party affiliations be listed on the general election ballot for Ohio Supreme Court candidates. And as you said, his son, Pat DeWine, is a justice on the Ohio Supreme Court who is likely to be running for chief justice next year. Now, the bill also would put the judicial races higher on the ballot. A lot of people, you know, don't get to the judges lower down on the ballot. So this would apply to Ohio Supreme Court and state appellate court seats, but not the local races. So the people supporting this bill say this is about transparency, educating the public, you know, so the voters know who they're voting for. But the Democrats would say it's blatantly political, since, you know, it just so happens the Democrats have made inroads into the Supreme Court in recent years, you know, with this setup, while Republicans have dominated other statewide offices at the top of the ticket. So a spokeswoman for DeWine said he thinks it's the right thing to do to sign this bill to make the political parties, transparent to the voters in the general election. And you know, interestingly, DeWine, you know, doesn't have to sign it. He could just let it become law, or he could veto it. I mean, I didn't really expect him necessarily to veto it. But the other interesting thing is that Andrew Tobias, who did this story, talked to Pat DeWine, Justice Pat DeWine. And, you know, he could be in a Republican primary, actually, against another justice, Sharon Kennedy, for this chief justice seat. He, you know, he said he supports the bill. In fact, he's been out there on the circuit, like, he did a debate on it where he argued in favor of it that was hosted by the Cleveland Bar Association, which doesn't like this, by the way, you know, because they think it promotes the politicization of the court. But anyway, Pat DeWine said something funny. He said, you know, if you don't know somebody named DeWine running for election in Ohio as a Republican, I don't know where you've been living for the past few years. So he kind of dismissed it, said he didn't really think it was going to affect his race.
No, and pragmatically speaking, it probably wouldn't. I mean, Ohio is the only state that has the weird system where you run in a partisan primary and you run in a nonpartisan general election, and it does deprive the voter of transparency. I also wonder whether with Jennifer Bruner running for Supreme Court justice, having a Democratic candidate with her name recognition at the top of that ballot might subvert what the Republicans are trying to do here. Now, the whole issue, though, comes down to just the perception of a conflict. If DeWine had said, look, my son's on Supreme Court, it's probably going to be running next year, so I'm not going to veto or sign this. I'll just let it become law so it doesn't have the appearance that I'm doing anything that might help him. Would have felt a little cleaner. Him signing.
You kind of wonder why he didn't do that. I mean, it's not like they were rushing to have this bill take effect right away or something like
and
that.
And he could have said it. He could have explained it just like that. Look, I don't want to have the appearance that I'm using my office to help my son, so I'm just going to let the legislature have complete control of this and I won't touch it. Instead, he signed it, raises the question. This is why we did the story. Kudos to your staff, Jane. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Why is 55 Public Square getting $5 million in historic tax credits? Does anyone look at that building and think it is beautiful in a historic sense? Laura Johnston, this building is literally 3 years older than I am, which means I'm historic, I guess. I just, why? Who decides that's a historic building worth saving? It's a big mirror box, a modernist structure from a period in America where the architecture isn't all that celebrated, right?
Right. I mean, it's pretty plain looking. It looks like it could be an office tower in any city in America, really. 24 stories tall, but it is on Public Square, so it has a pretty public face. But saying that, you know, I read the story and I was like, I got to look to see what this building even looks like, because it's not something you would remember. No, but I guess it was the headquarters for the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company at one point, and it was called the Illuminating Building. And it's getting $5 million from the state. That's the most of any building in the state, though other cities' projects are also getting that amount of money. And these come out twice a year, the Historic Preservation Tax Credit. It's a highly competitive process. There's $36 million worth of credits getting passed out right now for 31 projects in 51 historic buildings across the state. And developers really depend on being able to get these as part of their financing to make, you know, to make these projects make sense for them. Because K&D Group bought this building for $17 million, and they plan to, I mean, I think put like $40 million or $60 million into it. So, I mean, that's a decent
okay. All right.
Out of it.
But there are other programs. If you really believe this is important for downtown development and in the future of Cleveland, there are other programs you could probably find to help the building out. But the historic tax credit program was put together to make sure we don't lose historically significant treasures. But, you know, the old stone church and the old Cleveland courthouse. I mean, I think everybody would look at those and say, wow, you know, you couldn't do those today. We want to keep them. But who decides that this building from 1958 should be preserved? I mean, is the next step we're going to say, you know what? Let's not build a new jail. Let's get historic tax credits and we'll give them to the jail.
The ugly modernist 70s jail.
Right. It's how is that any different? The Justice Center versus 55 Public Square.
I mean, you could make that argument. I mean, they got a lot of historic tax credits for the modernist brutalist building that is next to the Rotunda, right? I'm losing the name of it. But plenty of people thought that was ugly And they're like, no, this is architecturally significant. And I guess you could argue about that, but the Historic Preservation Board is the one that looks at it. I'm sure they have, you know, it has to be this old to get it done. But there were other ones on the list that I think are a little bit more historic, like the Akron Beacon Journal Building in downtown Akron, which, you know, is from the 30s, and they have all these original stairways and terrazzo floors that they want to keep as when they turn it into an apartment building. And it had a really cool like clock tower. That's one of the agoras getting $250,000. So, I mean, there are some buildings on here that you would say, okay, those are a little bit more memorable. But, you know, it's a decent question, and it happens twice a year. So I bet you there's a lot of buildings on there that you'd be scratching your head about.
I don't know, Jane Coon. What do you think about 1958 being declared historic?
Oh, my God. Does this mean I have to say, like, no, how old I am or whether I was alive then?
No, I just it's one that I don't think 1958 strikes us as an era of historic. Leila Atassi.
Yeah, I'm wondering, do these tax credits come with some restriction on what can be done to the buildings in the renovation process? I mean, does it need to preserve the historic nature of the architecture? What I mean, I'm unclear on why it has to be linked to, because I'm looking at down the list of all the other projects that are getting the tax credits, like the Akron Beacon Journal Building in Akron, and it sounds like they're completely renovating that into apartments and things like that.
No.
Well,
but
that's what they're doing in the 55 Public Square too. It's going to be apartments, but they keep
It sounds like there's some preservation going on, but there must be a lot of overhaul also happening. Like, what are the limitations on what can be done to these buildings? Does it have to still look like it does today? I don't know. What are the rules?
I don't know all the rules.
No. I don't know. Does anybody really feel strongly about maintaining anything about 55 Public Square?
No, that's what I'm wondering is, like, does it have to look like that forever?
Once they build the Sherwin-Williams Tower, that you're not really going to be able to see it from Public Square, right? I mean, because it's next to that parking lot.
All right. Well, interesting. I do want to see a follow-up on who decided that was a historic building worth saving. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's the latest step in building a new Cuyahoga County jail to replace the one that has been labeled as inhumane at various times? Well, Atassi, they're moving full speed ahead, even though I don't know how they're going to pay for this thing.
Maybe historic tax credits? No. So during a council hearing on Tuesday, committee approved an $8 million contract for a criteria architect who'd be responsible for the conceptual plans that will eventually let the county hire a builder. They chose engineering firm HOK, which is based in St. Louis and has a pretty strong presence in Cleveland and has worked on jail projects throughout the Midwest. The firm will spend this first year familiarizing itself with the existing plans and drawing up some designs and helping the county determine a maximum price as part of the process of hiring a builder. But what made this hearing really fascinating was the fact that it was the first time county council had been briefed at all on the jail plans. A 12-member steering committee made up of representatives from County Executive Armin Budish's administration, one county council member, the Common Pleas Court, and Prosecutor Mike O'Malley's office have been hashing out plans for nearly 3 years. But finally, council got a chance to ask questions about this project. So they asked things about, you know, the difficulty of transporting inmates from the new jail to the courthouse. Currently, the buildings are connected at the Downtown Justice Center. They asked whether creating a facility that could accommodate as many as 2,400 inmates would lead to the size of the jail population ballooning again out of control. They asked about the lifespan of the new building, which apparently would be 30 to 40 years. They asked what would come of the current Justice Center site and what would be the potential for redevelopment there. But they didn't ask about affordability of this project. And this was like a 3-hour hearing. They didn't ask, you know, how the county plans to pay for this $500 million project and how that debt comports with the $1.25 billion in debt already on the books for the county, which Courtney Astolfi detailed so well in a story last weekend. So she's chasing all of those answers as we speak. But just kind of interesting that you know, cost and affordability were the elephants in the room during this hearing where they danced around with all these other details.
I know. It's like they're buying the furniture for a house, but they don't know if they can buy the house. It's just strange to me we're going down this road. And I look forward to Courtney's story because somebody's got to ask these questions. The county council repeatedly falls down on its duty. The first question they should have had is, wait, before we spend $8 million on the architect, do we have $500 million for this project? Is it anywhere that we can come up with? What are the possible financing methods given the tight debt ceiling we have? What's the creative way we're going to do this? And instead, they ask all sorts of technical questions without, like you said, the elephant in the room. It's mind-boggling that these are the stewards of our tax dollars. Mm-hmm. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Well, that does it for a Thursday. Come back tomorrow as we wrap up a week of news. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Jane. Thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast.